Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Chinese Studies. I'm your host, Julia Kabinska, and I'm joined today by Corey Burns to discuss his book, Fixing Landscape, A Technopoetic History of China's Three Gorges. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks, Julia. It's nice to be here.
So I must admit that I have a prior relationship with Corey as a classmate. Well, not a classmate, but as an alumni of the illustrious Berkeley Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures. And I've invited him here today to talk about his really epic and elegant book, epic in scale, because it covers thousands of years of history of media writing, eco-criticism, in fact, the way that Corey writes it, about the Three Gorges Dam. But before we get to that fascinating book, I just wanted to introduce Corey very briefly. He is Associate Professor of Chinese Culture at Northwestern, both in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures and the Program in Comparative Literary Studies. At Northwestern, Corey is the co-founder and co-director of the Kaplan Institute for the Humanities Environmental Humanities Workshop, a program that is undoubtedly very relevant to the work that he'll present in this book. And this past year, he has been a fellow at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies, working hard on his next project, which we will also hear about in the interview. But before we get to the next project, let's focus on this one. And Corey, I'm going to begin actually, my first question will come from the very first lines of your book. You say, "I still remember the first time I tried to articulate the half-formed ideas that inspired this project. At the end of my PhD qualifying exams, I explained to my committee that I wanted to write a dissertation that spanned two millennia in which I would think comparatively about Tang poetry and contemporary film. It would have been easy for them to dismiss this plan as ill-conceived, but instead they didn't. They actually engaged you in a very, like I said, elegant project that came together in this book. So could you tell us a little bit about how you came to this project, and perhaps before that, how you came to this field, and who your intellectual influences at Berkeley or wherever they may have come from were?
Sure. Well, thank you for those kind words and the generous introduction. I'm not sure what field I'm in, so it's a little hard to answer that question of, you know, how did I come to this field? Because I have made an effort to occupy some interstitial spaces between fields, and I know that people say that kind of thing a lot. And it's true to varying degrees for different people. I think it is definitely the case for me that I, although I'm trained in Chinese studies, am also in or working in or engaging other fields in really serious ways. So I'm still figuring out what my field is. I think it's maybe a field of my own creating to a certain extent, although, you know, one does not always have complete liberty when it comes to these things. But I had a personal connection to China. I had family who were living there. And although I hadn't been studying Chinese at all in college, I decided to take some time off of school. And I moved in with my relatives there and studied Chinese. And I haven't stopped since. And when I went back to school, I continued to do that and just put one foot in front of the other. initially what I thought I would do, and what I did do in a master's program was I worked on pre-modern literature. And when I arrived at Berkeley, I was also working mostly in pre-modern literary studies, medieval Chinese literary studies, poetry. And much of my coursework was in that area, actually. And so I think I realized at a certain point in graduate school that that's not where I wanted to make my intellectual home, even though I loved a lot of the material I was working with and had an amazing, advisor in Paolo Varsano. But I really made a transition away from pre-modern material into the modern contemporary period, which is what I work on mostly now these days, through my dissertation project and through the relationships I built with faculty at Berkeley, especially, as I said, Paolo Varsano, but also Andrew Jones, who's our shared advisor, co-advisor of my project, and a great influence on my work and my writing. So I came to the field sort of unexpectedly, but through that personal connection, and have been sort of working my way through different sectors of Chinese studies and beyond over the years. As for the project, it was really a pretty basic desire to write about two different cultural objects. One from the pre-modern period, these eight poems by Du Fu from the mid-8th century, the Qiuxing Basho, which are incredibly famous, often seen as the sort of pinnacle of the Chinese poetic tradition, or one of the peaks of the Chinese poetic tradition, classical tradition, and Jia Zhongke's 2005 film, Still Life. And so I encountered those two objects right around the same time at the start of graduate school. I was taking a seminar on Du Fu in my first year, which was a truly painful experience, although a really rewarding experience as well. And it was right around that time that I also saw Still Life. And I thought, well, these objects, both, I found them transformative aesthetically, but because they were about the same place, I thought there has to be a way to write about these two things together. And the dissertation came out of this instinct, basically, that it was possible, or rather that it was not just possible, but that there was something worthwhile in writing about a pre-modern text and a contemporary text together, that in juxtaposing them, and that really is the primary method in a way of the dissertation, that in juxtaposing them, I would learn something new and maybe otherwise difficult to know about each of them, kind of by approaching them obliquely, or maybe very obliquely, even anachronistically.
Yeah, I think you definitely have shown us things that we wouldn't have necessarily known without this approach. So I'm very interested in the construction of your book, and we'll get into that a little bit as we talk about how each part is composed of two chapters that speak to each other and how those three parts of the book speak to themselves. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about the stakes and the conversations of your project, right? You say that you're writing about, quote, landscape ideas that act materially in the production of space, right? So that's the most broad description. How the aesthetics of landscape are put to use to, quote, fix it or produce a kind of cultural coherence across millennia, right? So if you could prepare the ground for us, so to speak, so that listeners will know what we're talking about as we get deeper and deeper into each one of the chapters of your book.
Yeah. There are a couple of questions there. Before talking about my interlocutors or the fields that I'm working with, maybe it's useful just to say that I, in conceiving of the prod, let's see, in the transition from the dissertation to the book, there were some significant changes, and the dissertation to a certain extent had an elegiac quality to it, a sort of sense of loss that predominated, that what appears in contemporary representations is sort of focused on what's been lost in the the fixing or the transformation of this landscape through this massive dam project. And obviously a lot has been lost, and I talk about that in the book, but I really tried to move away from an elegiac narrative that was focused on what was lost, because it seemed to me that there were misconceptions about what had persisted in an unchanging way over the course of 2,000 years. And so I thought that there was a useful intervention to be made in how people had written about this particular landscape. And this particular intervention in the landscape is somehow severing an aesthetic tradition and destroying a landscape. It did to a certain extent, but I thought that the story was much more complicated. And by avoiding a strictly elegiac approach, I thought that, you know, that there would be something useful for other people as well who are interested in thinking about historical rupture, historical change, but also the status of tradition, for want of a better word. So that was, I think that was one of the differences between the dissertation and the book, and one of the interventions I wanted to make in how people wrote about this particular place, but also maybe how people thought about the status of quote unquote Chinese traditions in the present moment. But the book itself is really a multi-part conversation. Obviously, it's just me having a conversation with myself, but that's made possible by reading in fields like cultural geography, in particular art history, film studies, trauma studies, the environmental humanities, definitely. I wanted to bring, you know, in particular the insights of landscape studies and cultural geography to bear on this particular context, to think about this relay between representational and material cultures, which are never really separate. But I think the kind of force of the representational tradition in the Chinese context is such that it's easy to lose sight of how the physical space is being transformed by its representational cultures. This idea that the landscape doesn't look quite enough like its representations, and so it must be changed so that it can stay the same, or so that it can look more as it does in its representations. And that, I discovered in writing the book, is something that's been going on for a very, very long time, much longer than I thought. And so definitely landscape studies, cultural geography helped me to see that light, and hopefully to bring it a little closer to Chinese studies and its spatial, to scholars working on spatial questions in Chinese studies.
Absolutely. That comes across quite strongly in the book, and also in an article that I imagine is related but is not actually part of the book, Landscapes of Desolation, which is a piece that I've assigned to students, including undergraduate students, who, it's a very elegant piece, so sometimes they find it a little bit difficult, but we do have a great time walking through it and unlearning that those ideas about landscape, especially Chinese landscape, right, as this ineffable past. And so I recommend that as well to our listeners, and I recommend it as a teaching text, not only as something that you will read only for your enjoyment as a scholar, but also as a teacher of these young students who actually really need to understand these terms, right? This is a book that has very big stakes insofar as the reshaping of Chinese landscapes, of Chinese ecologies, has an impact on not just China, but actually in a way that the book narrates, and the various figures that come into contact in the modern period, especially with this region, will say this is about the world, right? This Three Gorges project is an extractive colonial project. It's a socialist sort of dream project. And ultimately now it is a kind of post-socialist ruination and neoliberal exploitation, right? So why don't we begin though with the first part before we get into the modern period? This is for me a very indulgent part of the book because I'm also a modernist, but I do love reading about pre-modern poetry in particular, and Corey has a very great style in analyzing these poems and in conducting close readings. So that's another thing you'll find in the book. It is full of very careful, meticulous close readings of all sorts of media texts. So in the first instance, we'll be dealing with Du Fu, the famous, most famous perhaps poet of the Chinese tradition. And the chapter is called Tracing the Gorges. So can you tell us about how this textual gorge, Three Gorges region, is produced in Du Fu's work in that chapter?
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, the chapter itself moves back and forth between the pre-modern and the modern slash contemporary period. So there is within the chapter itself a kind of toggling or juxtaposition, which is meant to or designed to work against a kind of chronological logic. Basically, the chapters move chronologically, but within each chapter, there's a kind of back and forth. And I think that's specifically designed to show the continued relevance of that, of the past and how it's rewritten in the contemporary moment, as a way to inform readings of pre-modern texts, such that the approach is not just a strictly philological or hermeneutic approach. I think Du Fu is really the first, he's certainly not the first person to write about the region. People have been writing about it for well over 1,000 years by the time that he arrives, but he's one of the first people who is a prolific poet, who spent a lot of time, a couple of years in the gorges, and wrote many, many, many poems about it. And these were poems that were deeply connected to a tradition, meaning that they tended to be conventional in some ways, that they were familiar references to landscape features, to mythology, to figures who had been there before, structures, ruins, etc. Classical Chinese poetry is always highly elusive and often highly conventional. And, you know, Du Fu's poems are highly elusive and in some ways conventional, but he really expanded what could be contained by the conventions or the traditions centered on this landscape. So he wrote about more things, and he wrote about the region in greater detail. And, you know, he made it into a personal landscape, a landscape of isolation, of displacement, a kind of medium for his suffering. And that was something that was mostly very new. So just the sheer quantity of poetry he wrote about the region, and then also this kind of personalization of some of the very familiar, highly conventional themes that previous poets had used to write about the region, often without having been there. Right? So certain landmarks had been incorporated into larger landscape traditions to the extent that one could write poetry about the region in a fairly rote or performative way, without needing to go there. But Du Fu did go there. And so he changed the tradition as a result by kind of by writing in place in a really intimate and biographical way.
And long after his death, but long before our own times, many other literati took him up, right? And if in the first chapter we have a sort of textual record, right, that is created through Du Fu's poetry, the second chapter, the pair in this first part, is actually tracing how Du Fu himself becomes a sort of inscription onto the physical landscape. And you, again, you're working, as you noted, chronologically, but also with multiple time periods. So could you tell us a little bit about how Du Fu is taken up as a Three Gorges figure in the various moments that you write about in the second chapter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he becomes a kind of landmark, and he becomes part of a convention about writing, a convention in literature about the Three Gorges, particularly in the Song Dynasty, but then from the Song, Northern Song onwards. So that it is not required exactly, but readily available and quite common when passing through certain spots to evoke Dufu as a kind of human landmark in a way. And at certain moments, particularly in the Song Dynasty, that was certainly an intertextual practice, a kind of elusive practice where you might evoke Dufu by writing about him or citing his poetry when passing through the region and writing your own poetry. But it took material forms through the construction of various, I think we could probably safely say, touristic landmarks or touristic sites that had a quasi ritualistic function. Perhaps there were shrines to Dufu, but that were also part of a Song Dynasty, and then in later periods, travel industry, more or less. And there are some really fascinating texts from the Song Dynasty in particular about, about the reconstruction of properties that he supposedly lived in, that would allow you then to go and occupy the same space. And this is still the case. I mean, this happens all the time in China, and I write about that a little bit, right? In Chengdu, you can still go to Dufu's thatched hut, and it's still, it's still there, supposedly. And this happens, at various moments, as part of, a touristic culture, and then also as part of a sort of Dufu's elevation to near the peak or the peak of the literary tradition in that historical moment, often not simply by virtue of the quality of his writing, but by virtue of its moral power. And so that these sites that one visits are literary sites, but they're also sites where you might kind of reinstantiate moral values in an embodied way, right, by going there. And I think, I think that sort of expression of maybe a cult of Dufu represents something different from earlier periods where you could write about this landscape without ever having gone there. That's still the case. That was always the case. But there is a real interest in being there and in going to the exact places that former people, in this case, Dufu, had been, and really getting some kind of indexical thrill from that.
I like the idea of the indexical thrill. And I there's a very interesting discussion there about these terms of authenticity, right? And what does it mean to be in the place and the physical place versus the textual place? And the way that really the Chinese practice here throws a wrench into many of our Western, or at least founded in Western thought, ideas of authenticity or historical realness, right? Indexicality. So for those of you who are interested in the poetic tradition, and though we have been talking about Dufu Libai, perhaps the other top poet of the Chinese tradition also makes an appearance. But I was perhaps most thrilled in terms of my own work or the direction my own work is going with the second part, the reinscribing of the Three Gorges. I was recently reading Mark Reisner's very classic text about the American West and water infrastructures, and was thrilled to discover that actually the architect of America's dams makes an appearance here. And in fact, we shift really archives, right? We move away from not only the pre-modern period, but also from the Chinese tradition per se. You have many Chinese actors who are not able to express themselves, right? Whose muteness or inability to be represented is in fact something that you take up, especially in the fourth chapter about Chinese labor. But we are dealing primarily in texts produced by Westerners or by Chinese navigators, map makers, in conversation with this desire to exploit the Chinese landscape, right? So one of the things that I really liked about the way you framed this chapter is the realization of Chinese landscape, right? How do we make this place that appears like a Garden of Paradise and a China Plate, China on China, as you put it in the book. How do we make it real, right? How do we, and by we, I mean, I'm stepping a little bit into the shoes of these British explorers who want to map and then ultimately perhaps not themselves, but this project is part of this exploitative process of making this, these three gorges, this treacherous and difficult to navigate terrain, seeable, knowable, and useful. So if you could tell us about perhaps not just what this chapter is about, but how you came to orient the second part in such a different time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was hard. The two central chapters of the book really represented a lot of new research in periods that I hadn't worked in before, but I felt that it was necessary to have both a little more historical coverage, but to think more carefully about, what I describe as a reinscription of this landscape in the modern period. It's hard not to talk about the earlier version of the project, the dissertation, but that really was a kind of juxtaposition of pre-modern and modern contemporary materials. And there was a gap of something like 1200 or 1300 years between chapter two and chapter three. And I thought, okay, well, obviously that's too much of a gap. There are always going to be gaps in a project like this because you cannot do everything. But I wanted to look a little more closely at a moment when I think the landscape was being, or people imagined that they were rediscovering or discovering this landscape and really reconceptualizing it. That said, I think what I'm invested in finding the similarities between this earlier moment of trying to, again, make the landscape look more like its representations for various reasons, aesthetic reasons, or so that it can fulfill a kind of moral purpose. That there's an attempt there to fix that landscape, to realize in the present what it might have been or what you imagined to have been in the past. And so there is a similarity there, although there's a kind of radically different, there are radically different epistemologies and maybe technologies of landscape at play in this period. And so I think I've lost my train. Help me out here. What?
No, this is really fascinating. I had a suspicion that this wasn't in the dissertation, although I'm not familiar with the shape of that. But I like the way it anchors these two points and sort of plays between the modern, contemporary modern, and the pre-modern period, right? Because it's set in the late Qing and the Republican period, and it introduces Western actors and Western texts and Western ways of seeing, which will indelibly color the way this project evolves, right? In the end of the book with the socialist and the post-socialist Three Gorges.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, I think this was the most fun part of the project to write, possibly because it was new material. And of course, I hadn't really written about or so much about English language materials in the past. But it was clear to me that that there was something new going on. And one of the reasons this material was so fascinating and so useful is because although there are many examples that of texts that are written in full knowledge of the landscape tradition and in English or in other languages, that invoke that landscape tradition, that visit the same sites, and that are in a way, I would argue, part of that tradition, even though they're written in Western languages not by Chinese people. But at the same time, I think that it was a first moment where you could really find evidence of an alternative, maybe nascent at first, landscape tradition centered on this place that was not just about the exact same literary landmarks, mythological landmarks, so that your interest was drawn instead to the bed of the river, to the banks of the river, to navigational hazards. And in reading these Western texts, you see, of course, that the knowledge of the river Western knowledge or a kind of scientific reinscription of the river is dependent on the knowledge of local people who had been inhabiting the region, traveling along the river for millennia, basically. Although obviously there are historical differences in different periods. It's not a unbroken, homogenous tradition by any extent. And so just finding that interplay of a local and in particular an embodied experience of the river and a kind of mediatized scientific cartographic understanding, which is you know, obviously what I think I describe in the book as maybe the immediate but not ultimate precondition for the dam project. Right? So this is a an engagement with a reconceptualization of the river that is the most obvious sort of historical starting point for the dam project. So that in order to even think about the construction of a dam, you know, you'll have to think about it in hydrologic terms, in geological terms. You'll have to fit it in a kind of longitudinal, latitudinal grid. It has to be sort of seen that way first. But ultimately, what's fascinating is just what's happening at the same time that that project is ongoing, and that's much more nuanced, and it has much more to do with kind of the physical labor that was still required in that historical moment to navigate the river, in particular the need for trackers to pull boats up and down the river, who appear very often in nonfiction accounts, but also later in some fictional accounts as maybe not surprisingly as kind of elegiac figures, as figures of disappearance.
So just for our listeners, the first chapter of this part is about the Chinese landscape, and it tracks, introduces a lot of modern maps, geological information. But not to worry, we're still firmly in the realm of aesthetics as well. So you will be, I think, very pleased with the way that Corey takes up these maps and how he performs the close readings. But the next chapter is about Chinese labor, and it really is about this figure of the tracker, Corey, that you've mentioned. And you posit him now as this elegiac figure, but in the text there is actually a really interesting concern for the future that's going on here that I found quite fascinating. The tracker as this type, this Chinese laboring type, who, as you say, in the accounts of Westerners is sort of the limit of the human, right? Subhuman, because animal-like, but then also potentially superhuman. So this body that has become, that is both so traditional and so pre-modern, but also so technologized as to be terrifying. So could you tell us a little bit more about that concern about the tracker?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for a lot of Western travelers, maybe particularly British and American, the tracker was a kind of coolie, or as at least one of the writers that I talk about in this section of the book says, like the most debased, or the sort of the form of coolie labor that was most debased, because because it brought the laborer the closest to some kind of animal state where all that was required was brute force. So the tracker just gets swept up in a fairly well studied and maybe predictable language of the coolie of Chinese labor, which of course is part of a larger discourse of yellow peril or anxiety about Chinese labor in the American West in particular, although it finds manifestations in other parts of the world as well. I think what was one thing that was interesting is that it becomes a convention, and it becomes a convention that is not, I mean, that functions in a way that's not that dissimilar from the conventions you find in pre-modern sources. in that everyone who goes there writes about the tracker. They all do it. It becomes part of the scenery. They often write about it in the same way, or they cite the same people. They talk about their singing. They talk about their nudity. There are some instances that are more detailed, others that are less. But the tracker becomes a kind of new convention in an expanded landscape tradition. And in the pre-modern period, they don't appear very often at all in poetry about the Three Gorges region, despite the fact that we know they were pulling boats up and down the river, right, that their labor was essential to travel, particularly upstream. But they're not conventional, and so they mostly don't appear, with some exceptions. So to find a new convention in formation at a moment when that's so well documented in a way, was really, really fascinating. That was just a fascinating discovery to sort of see that. And also to see, I think, how, instantly this particular place gets swept up in what could only be described as global conversations about labor and technology. So there's a kind of almost instantaneous, how should I put it? There's just a sense of maybe the centrality of a landscape like this to larger conversations, that it becomes easy for outsiders to sort of project onto it. But also it's clear that, it is very quickly incorporated into larger conversations about labor, and then especially about trade with China. And that happens early.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to read, for example, the work of Isabella Bird, who is this, has a sympathetic gaze, right? Which is a type of gaze that you'll problematize, and I do want to get to that. But one of the things that was striking to me to read and resonates with a prior interview that I did on this channel is the way in which these rich Europeans write about Chinese laborers, to me, is it's a sort of maybe a willful blindness to the conditions of labor that European subalterns are going through as well, right? The Chinese body, that it can withstand anything, right? And here, like, turning back to this prior book, Aaron Huang's Urban Horror, in which she talks about the factory is actually a locus of one of the first modern horrors. So there is a bigger story to be told there. However, what really hinges this chapter to the rest of the book is this ethical concern also. And by the rest of the book, I mean the remaining chapters that we have to talk about still. And this question of the ethics of the sympathetic gaze, right? And of representation. And if the first few chapters were about struggling, dispossessed elites like Dufu, nevertheless elites, right? And now we're trying to describe the Three Gorges as the experience of these sometimes laboring and sometimes dispossessed and running away people on the margins, right? Not the doofus of the world. So could you tell us a little bit about these questions that you ask about the ethics of looking at the Three Gorges and the people who inhabited them?
Yeah. I mean, I think your what you just said is helpful. We were talking earlier about, or I was saying earlier before we started recording, how difficult it is to step back into a project that's been done for a couple of years. One, to remember what you said, but also to sort of think about it, you know, as a whole and in its parts. One of the transformations that I am tracking that I thought was important to track, partly because of a dominant narrative of the unchanging quality of this landscape and its traditions, was this shift from a landscape that signified primarily or even exclusively through an elite culture, elite writers, elite figures, through to the present day, when particularly in works of art that are responding to the Three Gorges Dam, we see the landscape with traces of that tradition, but as a setting for the embodied experience of impoverished people, basically, of poor people, of laborers, of people who are being dispossessed. And so there is a shift from a kind of elite landscape tradition dominated by well-known writers and figures and people who would have been incredibly privileged, although perhaps dispossessed or displaced, to a landscape tradition that is informed by that aesthetically, but really radically differently focused on other forms of dispossession and displacement. And so I wanted to think, partly engage because I was engaging with these 19th century and early 20th century writers who were so sort of grotesquely focused on the bodies of these laborers, their sufferers, their nudity, the constantly talking about them in ways that seemed to verge on the sadistic and sometimes the sexualized. But that would often, in the case of Isabella Bird, be framed in a sympathetic light. And she's, of course, one of the more sympathetic, and her sympathy is manifests in the greater detail of her description, which has a kind of contradictory effect, because it is objectifying in a really dramatic way. I think reading that, reading that material and writing those chapters before moving on to the contemporary material was useful because it just reminded me of the dangers that we all confront but don't always acknowledge when writing about modern and contemporary China in particular. A lot of people have written about pain and suffering in 20th century China and in contemporary China. I think a lot more of us need to do that, if only because so much of the material that one encounters or that scholars are attracted to is a cultural production of horror and suffering and pain. And it's very easy, whether you're writing about the contemporary period or the modern period, to just sort of write about awful things and the suffering of people who are really far removed from your lived experience. And it was helpful to write about someone, like Isabella Bird and others, and to think about how I might avoid writing in a similar mode about the suffering of people who are alive now and living in these places now. And so partly, I just wanted to make explicit these things that are not always made explicit, to say, look, what are the ethical stakes of writing about people who are very, very, very different from me, who are experiencing things that, or experiencing a precarity or a vulnerability that I have never experienced and will probably, hopefully, never experience, in a context where writing about them benefits me because it's my job. I mean, not that I make money from this book or anything, but it's what I do. It's how I make a living. I mean, obviously I read about a lot of different things, but there's a kind of cultural capital that comes from that. And I wanted to think through the stakes of that a little more carefully by saying, well, I understand that, that maybe just by acknowledging those issues in particular.
Absolutely. It's something that I think about as well, perhaps not as much in relation to my own work, which is focused a little bit differently, but it comes up so often in our field, right? These stories of sympathy and morality that are somehow unchecked in their own gazes. So I really appreciate what you did here with your work. So let's turn then to the end of the book and the two chapters that are in the contemporary period. And the first is about Jia Zhangke's film Still Life, one of the best treatments of this film that I've read, but one that's very much in conversation with scholarship on Chinese cinema and its relationship to landscape and to painting. But perhaps instead of thinking about Chinese landscape, which you do, in fact, in renaming the tracking shot as a scrolling shot, I think that's a nice move, and I really appreciated that. But what I thought was most productive for me and most new was the way in which you engage the socialist visual tradition in combination with these quote-unquote traditional landscape aesthetics to explore what Jia does in his film that, you know, answers to these questions of power and ways of seeing. So if you could tell us a little bit about that aspect of the fifth chapter.
I think that what I wanted to do was, one of the things I wanted to do was to show how this, what had often been represented as a kind of unchanging tradition that was in the process of being destroyed, was in fact an incredibly changeable and vibrant tradition that was also in the process of being revived in this historical moment, partly because of this narrative of loss and of destruction, right, that might make it seem as though everything was being lost, but which in fact showed you that, okay, well, this tradition is incredibly alive, particularly in this moment. And that fact should help us to see maybe that, help us to see kind of other examples, earlier examples of changes within that tradition, because it's not been stable. And in this moment of instability, we can kind of see maybe how that tradition changes, expands, grows more vibrant, to a certain extent can be decoupled from the physical space of the Three Gorges, even as there continues to be this relay. I mean, as I said when we started the interview, this is one of the first things that made me want to write about the Three Gorges. I wanted to write about Still Life, and I wanted to write about Dufu, and I believe this was the first part of the book that I wrote. And so in a way, it's the oldest part of the book, and in some ways it's the part of the book that's changed the most over the years. And also that feels most distant to me at this point. I think, you know, there had been some writing about, I think in writing this material initially and in the book, I was responding to some problems that I saw in the field of Chinese studies, particularly modern Chinese studies. I was really dissatisfied, probably because I had been trained to a certain extent in pre-modern literary studies by how scholars of modern China, contemporary China, talked about tradition and its appearance in a film like Still Life or in other cultural objects at a moment when there was a real powerful and still ongoing revival of pre-modern kind of Chinese culture in contemporary cultural production. And there was a tendency to sort of identify traditional elements, right? Okay, well, here's a kind of traditional element, or the film takes the form of a regulated couplet or something like that. There was just a sort of, what felt to me sometimes like a simplistic account of historical allusions in contemporary texts. what I saw was something much more radical, like basically the refashioning of a pre-modern landscape tradition through the inclusion of, or maybe the juxtaposition of anachronistic forms, including socialist realist iconography, like landscape compositions, figural compositions. And I think one thing that Jiajiangke is doing is that he is sort of re-embedding these displaced figures in the landscape, in the pose or the guise of socialist realist figures. Again, keeping in mind that, you know, that landscape functions in a very different way in that visual culture than it does in an earlier moment. In the examples that I have in mind in this book, the figures dominate and the landscape is in the background. There's a sort of separation of figure and ground, and the figures tend to dominate the ground. And so Jia is invoking that, but also integrating landscape and figure in a slightly different way, partly kind of through the extra mediation of this earlier landscape tradition, the sort of scrolling aesthetic. And I think it's a sort of invocation of the promises maybe of an earlier socialist moment, even as it's a sort of ironic commentary on the failures of that, you know, of that, of that earlier moment, of its promises and of the visual culture that it produced. I think it's really, I mean, I don't know, this maybe is a cop-out. I think it's really, what's going on is really complicated. I think that there are so many, partly because it is so deeply intertextual or intermedial, that there are lots of ways to read these moments that are ironic, that are elegiac, that resemble earlier moments of, in particular, socialist visual culture, even as they more fully integrate or combine figure and landscape in ways that neither a pre-modern tradition nor the socialist tradition ever really did. And so there's a kind of creation in certain moments of a really balanced figural and landscape form, which doesn't have that many precedents, I would say, in this context.
Yeah, I was recently teaching the other very famous landscape film in modern Chinese history, Yellow Earth. And there's been lots that's been written about that film that's quite compelling, but I was itching. I was like, oh, I wonder if Corey can write something that I can assign to my students, because that film is very different. But I think that the critical viewpoint you bring to this film might be also somehow transferable, with difference, of course, to that earlier text, which is also about the lost promise of that socialist gaze. But let's move on then to the last set piece, last case study of your book, which is the art of Ji Yunfei, right? This artist who is wrestling with both historical traumas and anticipated traumas, right? So what I see as the kind of animating dialectic, so to speak, or question of that chapter is the problem that trauma is supposed to come after in a kind of unexpected way in a new place. But what Ji is doing is actually thinking about both what we would classically consider to be traumas, the aftermath of the cultural, the psychic aftermath of the Cultural Revolution, but also the anticipation or the presentness of the trauma of the Three Gorges. And he's doing that from far away and for a commission by a Western institution. If you could wrap up the story of your book, maybe with that last case before we end the interview by talking about that your next project. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think in retrospect, I wanted to, in writing about Ji Yunfei, whose work I like and find very interesting, I wanted to think about the Three Gorges as a as a global landscape, I mean, as a landscape that is really, really connected to the rest of the world at every level, at multiple historical moments. And I think that thinking about an artist like June Fay, who is based in the US and has been for a while, and who is represented by a gallery in New York and was producing one of the images that I write about in the book for the Museum of Modern Art, who then commissioned a famous woodblock gallery in China to produce a not mass produced, but very small and expensive run of woodblock, color woodblock printed versions of this painting of the Three Gorges Migration Scroll. And so I thought it was just an important part of thinking about how that we're not just talking about a Chinese landscape tradition, whatever that might mean, whether we can even talk about a landscape like that in those terms after a certain historical moment, in the modern contemporary period, I'm not so sure. And so this was helpful in thinking through that. But mostly, I mean, again, I think it was a way, I think it was also, G helped me to think a little bit about what it means to participate in a landscape tradition, and in this particular landscape tradition. And I think I see this book as a not just an account of that landscape tradition, but as part of it as well. I mean, unavoidably, I'm doing what many other writers before me have done, which is that I'm kind of looking at these landmarks and writing about them. And I'm writing about them, I'm writing about how they're written about, but I'm also, as a result, unavoidably writing about them. And so, what I really wanted to avoid, and I think a lot of people expected this with the projects, I really wanted to avoid a kind of like anthropological or explorer frame where I'm like, when I traveled down the Three Gorges in 2000 and whatever, and I had this experience and like, I was there, right? I did this, I went there. I didn't want to do that because I felt like it, for a variety of reasons, I didn't want to be an explorer. I didn't want to take this sort of, anthropological approach. But I don't think it did justice to how this landscape tradition actually worked, in that one does not need to go there. You can go there. And when you go there, you can do certain things and you can look for Gifu's traces or other ruins and you can have that experience. But it is as much a fantastical or imagined landscape as it is a real one. And it is one that you can have virtually, it's one that you can experience virtually. And that is something that's been happening for really over two millennia. And I think Jiyun Fei, who did travel, of course, to the Three Gorges, and you can see his writings about that and diaries and photographs that he took there. Of course, Jia Zhangke did the same thing. They went there. And I think that's something that is specific to how people approach the landscape now, is that, because you can go there, people go there, and there is that kind of documentary element. But the work that he produces is not entirely about the experience of having been there personally, but of capturing something that is not reliant on that personal embodied experience, even as it's focused on bodily suffering and the bodily suffering of others. And so I think G, like Jia, they were working at a moment when much of the damage had already been done, cities had been destroyed, people had been displaced, people were suffering, but the project wasn't done, right? It wasn't complete. And so how do you write about this trauma that is going to be an historical, multi-generational trauma at the level of the individual, but a cultural, social, and again, multi-generational trauma that is a sort of a challenge, and one that seems to sort of not fit very neatly with a particular psychoanalytic tradition or a kind of literary psychoanalytic tradition for understanding how trauma operates. So to write preemptively about a trauma that is unfolding or that will happen, and he does that by, again, by looking backwards and by sort of creating this landscape, palimpsestic landscape, in which the traumas of the contemporary displacement overlap, bleed into historical traumas, particularly the Cultural Revolution, but other there are other episodes that you find, including kind of moments of historical, you know, China's historical humiliation, Opium War, etc. And that becomes a method for looking backwards, becomes a method for looking ahead in a kind of predictive way. And yeah, and I think I was probably drawn to that as well because of because of the work that I do on the environment and sort of thinking about how you mourn for the future or how you kind of process a kind of trauma that is unfolding but that is deferred or that might be belong more to a generation to come than to your own. I think that was in the back of my mind, even though I'm not, you know, exactly writing about climate change or rising sea levels in that context. But unavoidably, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to think about the creation of a reservoir of these rising waters and not think about something like rising sea levels. And so that's a sort of a free associative thing, but I try to make those moves in this book as much as possible in the most rigorous way that I possibly could. I know it sounds a little bit like out there, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you were talking, I keep thinking about how perhaps this is one of the ruptures that we're living through is this mourning for the future, not just environmentally, although of course that's very prominent, but also a sort of the lost end of history, perhaps, right? This moment that we're living through in which we're anticipating ruination in various modes and in various parts of the globe. So for those of you who would like to think about that with Corey, I really recommend taking a look at this book. But before we finish, I want to ask you, Corey, what is your next project? I mean, this book, it's still new by Our Calculus, but it came out a few years ago. So I'm hoping, I'm anticipating, not mourning, but excited for the future of your work.
Yeah, so I am working on a project on threat. China as threat, China and threat. Partly it's a project that responds to the revival of or the kind of repurposing of a yellow peril rhetoric in the context of environmental anxiety, this perception of China as an environmental threat. And I'm approaching environment at the moment in a fairly broad way to encompass things like public health emergencies. So I've written a little bit about swine flu in particular, and I'm planning at some point to try, if possible, to write about COVID, SARS-CoV-2, although it's hard to write about, again, it's hard to write about something that's happening, but I have been thinking about that. And the piece that I published on swine flu came out during the pandemic and had sort of bizarrely, depressingly appropriate timing, because a lot of the sort of the things that I trace in that article happened again in the context of the current pandemic, in particular, a sort of fear in how the Chinese threat is figured. And so part of that project entails, you know, looking at that discourse and historicizing that and sort of thinking about you know, how the yellow peril is being repurposed in environmental context. That's a small part of it. Part of it is also looking at, I mean, trying to theorize threat as a useful concept in the environmental humanities, as opposed to a concept such as risk, which obviously is the subject of you know, whole corners of academia and of the insurance industry, and you know, has an actuarial purpose and is useful, but doesn't seem to go very far in capturing how environmental anxiety feels. And so threat to me as a sort of speculative, prospective account of what might possibly happen rather than what is probable or the probability of something happening strikes me as useful. And so I'm trying to theorize that as I put this sort of yellow peril, fear of China as threat culture, as I'm putting it, into a dialogue or in juxtaposition with expressions of environmental anxiety and threat coming from a Chinese cultural context. So trying to think about threat across the Pacific, not just in the US or in North America and other places, Australia, where China is fear, but also thinking about fear and environmental anxiety in China. To a certain extent, I think, you know, I think the second project does pick up a lot of the issues that I am working with in the first book. You know, threat is a speculative form. It's an imaginative form. It's a fictional form, but it's a, or mode, but it's one that's designed to make things happen, right? So there's a kind of pose that what you're talking about is the future when you speculate about threats. But the generally speaking, the goal is to make things happen now in the moment. And so again, there is a relay between an imaginative form or mode and real world impacts. And I wanted to look really closely at that through a couple of case studies, one that's focused, multi-chapter case studies, one that's focused on public health and the environment, so swine flu, COVID, and another that's focused on, as a sort of case study of how China as threat is physically embodied, and then another case study on the South China Sea and China's island building project there to think about the realization of the materiality of threat in the creation of these islands, and how this vision of China as a threat is running up against, a very long, rich, and really fascinating kind of anxiety about Chinese sovereignty and the threats posed to it by Western imperial powers, particularly in the Pacific. And so the project has become really a trans-Pacific project that is comparative and that is as much, I think, about North America and the US as it is about China. And that's been exciting and challenging, and we'll see comes of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very timely. And I'm looking forward to your realization of it as a book. So I will, if I'm still on this channel, I will certainly be inviting you back when that comes out. Thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the book, and I encourage our listeners to pick it up. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Julia.